From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Thanksgiving is a time we set aside to remember and acknowledge the good in our lives. Let's face it, acknowledgement is harder in some years than others, but remembering is always hard. That's why we're devoting this hour to the quirks and quiddities of memory, especially historical memory.
One thing we've been told about Donald Trump's rise to power is that it is an unprecedented event in American political history. Another thing we've been told relentlessly is that we're just reliving a previous fraught and damaging historical episode.
And like Nixon, Trump is evoking this image of, you know, I'm going to be the law and order candidate.
Sort of like Goldwater, right? 1964.
Is George Wallace a good template?
Yeah, I mean, Wallace is the best comparison in my mind.
Also, Donald Trump isn't the first celebrity to become president. Questions surrounded Ronald Reagan, too.
If only we can understand the past, we can avoid its mistakes, or at least chastise ourselves for being so blind. And the reluctant star of that narrative is author Rick Perlstein, chronicler of the Nixon times, the Goldwater times, the Reagan times, and other conflict-filled ideological struggles of the 20th century. In recent months, he's been to TV Bookers, a sort of Rosetta Stone of understanding.
Joining me now from Chicago is Rick Perlstein.
We'll speak with Rick Perlstein.
Our guest is Rick Perlstein.
Rick Perlstein, thanks for joining us tonight. We'll be right back.
Thing is, Perlstein himself rejects the premise. Nothing of the Trump phenomenon, he says, is an exact replay of the past. And equally, the supposedly unprecedented political moment has many precursors. Rick, welcome back to OTM.
Hi, Bob. Great to be here again.
So you wrote a piece for The Baffler, citing chapter and verse and naming names, about your growing status as oracle of the Trump age. And I'm sure it was very flattering, all of it, but you're having none of it.
Well, I'm glad to dive into the deep end and try and do what I can to make sense of what's happening in this very fraught civic movement. What I do reject is the idea that history can provide any easy answers. And unfortunately, within the media, easy answers are the coin of the realm. So I find myself a little bit at loggerheads.
As you go through the moments in history that you've written about, which ones are most often selected by cable TV bookers as the ones that supposedly best predict our current circumstances? Is it Nixon? Is it Reagan? Is it the John Birch Society? What is it?
All of the above. That's the striking thing. Someone will show up in social media and say, oh my God, Rick Perlstein's book on Nixon explains this exactly. And then the next person will say with equal confidence that Rick Perlstein's book on Reagan explains it perfectly. I think that the most popular parallel that folks have been reaching for is Richard Nixon's campaign in 1968. And of course, there are parallels. You know, he talked about the silent majority. Trump picked that up quite self-consciously. He talked about law and order. Trump picked that up quite self-consciously. But by the same token, you know, one of my pieces in the New Republic was about how Richard Nixon's famous speech at the 1968 nominating convention, which Trump's handlers specifically claimed as their model, was also a model of literary grace. It was also quite measured, and it talked about what should be our humility in the face of history's challenges.
Now, I'm obliged to ask you this, because some people out there, some irresponsible voices, have been making careless comparisons to Weimar Germany. And one of those irresponsible pundits is me, because the explanations of Trump's support, to me, absolutely parallel the concerns of those who brought Hitler to power.
Yes, I absolutely think that Weimar Germany has to be part of the mix in which we try and understand this. A good example is, you know, the New York Times in 1922 said of Hitler, well, no one really takes this anti-Semitism stuff seriously. You know, so not taking a demagogue seriously, that's a definite parallel. You don't have to say Trump is Hitler to believe in that. But we also have to go to, say, a place like 1930s Texas, in which a guy named Pappy Daniels, you know, won the governorship by traveling hobbling around with a cornpone, you know, hillbilly country band and would offer the same kind of hyper-populist, lowest common denominator stuff that Trump does now. The fact of the matter is Trump isn't Nixon. Trump isn't Reagan. Trump isn't George Wallace. Trump isn't Pappy Daniels. Trump is all of these things. And understanding him is going to take the kind of work that we're only beginning to embark upon.
If we can agree that nothing in the past is exactly a predictor of what is taking place now, and that many things in the past are predictors of what we're experiencing now, how do we process history smartly to figure out how to deal with this and normalize this as just the latest expression of the people's will?
Well, we don't normalize it. I would be the last person to argue for that. But I think that there's a ground to my explanations of history, which I think we really need to understand. One of the reasons we have a hard time understanding Trump is that American political culture, American media culture, is very much grounded in a sense that America is a nation that's united and at peace with itself. We really, really want to believe that.
We all seem to have bought into Walter Lippmann's idea that democracy is almost perfected. We're just working out a few remaining kinks.
But a more mature consideration of the broad sweep of American history, which of course was built upon papering over the fissure between slave states and free states, is that it's a much stranger, more violent, passionate, angry place than we give it credit for. I mean, whether it's the very violent nationwide railroad strikes in 1877, or the Dust Bowl, or almost 1,000 college campuses going out in strike in 1970, or the kind of rage that exiles and refugees from Southeast Asia faced when they came to this country in 1975, or whether it's Oklahoma City. We always see these violent, passionate incidents, and we always see them swept under the rug when it comes to this longing we have to believe that Americans can just come together and unite. Ultimately, what I'm trying to do with my work, and if I can make any contribution to this awesome, you know, awesome in the sense of terrifying movement that we're living through, it's that America is a messy place. And we all have to kind of open ourselves up to the possibility that we don't understand before we can really begin to understand.
You mentioned in your piece that the tendency to imagine any particular political moment as unprecedented makes us ignore a lot of nasty stuff from the past and to idealize it in a dangerous way. You call it historical narcissism. Is that what's going on now, or just some very scary clash of triumphalism and abject fear?
Well, what I said in the piece was that our historical narcissism indicts us. People were saying, oh my God, this is just like the scary riots in the 1960s, you know, the scary violence against police in the 1970s. And I came back with the point that my hometown of Chicago, in the riots after Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968, literally 2 entire miles of Madison Street were laid to waste. They were gone. In the riots in Baltimore after the death of Freddie Gray, 1 CVS was burned down. So this temptation we have to believe that we live in the most dramatic, unique, interesting times, it's not history, it's the opposite of history. We have to kind of attend to the particularity of each movement, but we also have to understand how each movement is determined by the past. I don't think we have a problem doing that when we think about biographies of people. We understand that each person is unique, but we also understand that each person is influenced by their parents. And we don't say they're just like their parents, but we don't say that they're completely independent of their parents. We kind of balance the two. We have to do the same thing with history.
So here's the axiom. Those who do not understand history are doomed to repeat it. Is that even true?
No, not really. I don't think history repeats itself. But, you know, as a wise man once said, it rhymes. There's always a good reason to understand history better. But once again, it's not to make the world simpler. It's to make the world richer and more complex.
Rick, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Rick Perlstein is a journalist, historian, and author, most recently of The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon, and The Rise of Reagan.
Up next, how the modern-day marketing of the Blitz-era slogan "Keep Calm and Carry On" trades on nostalgia to promote a very different approach to hard times.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 2 years ago, in a Washington bookstore, I first saw it, a poster that said, "Keep Calm and Carry On," a puckish piece of World War II nostalgia marketed with as much postmodern irony as the viewer cared to supply. And apparently, it struck a chord, because "Keep Calm and Carry On" is not just a poster, but a cottage industry imprinted on all manner of merchandise and sold worldwide as an icon of English resilience amid the Battle of Britain 76 years ago.
D is for our duty to give up all we can to the red collector when he brings round his van. Now we've hunted through the house, searched on every floor, just another little thing to help to win the war.
The thing is, we remember "Keep Calm and Carry On," even if we weren't alive during the London Blitz. We know what it signifies. Or do we? Owen Hatherley is author of the book The Ministry of Nostalgia, Consuming Austerity. When we spoke to him in May, he told us that the slogan was revived in Britain after the 2008 financial crash.
From then is when it completely goes nuclear. The boom, which people had been led to believe was going to go on forever, was bursting quite spectacularly. And I think it led to a certain degree of panic, leading to this kind of slightly ironic idea of, like, we're all going to muddle through and we're all going to be fine and keep calm and so on.
The message appeals to what you call austerity nostalgia.
Yeah.
It does evoke the Blitz-era British spirit of resistance to adversity. And as you say, it meshed, at least, with the prevailing political agenda. What was the agenda?
I think the agenda, and this has been especially clear since 2010, was a turn to austerity. And in Britain, the immediate post-war era is generally called the austerity era.
Because the economy was in ruins, because resources were scant.
Precisely. But what's interesting with that version of austerity was that it also was the period of the construction of the welfare state. There was this huge amount of public investment in trying to make society more equal and more fair. And so what's kind of curious is when they opted to describe what they were going to do after 2010 as austerity, it was about dismantling that welfare state, but the exact same word had been used for it. It was a sort of destruction of that era cloaked in the garb of that era.
The message from government on both sides of the Atlantic was to tighten your belt, but don't stop, you know, spending.
Yes, there's a couple of government slogans which kept going around when David Cameron was first elected, like, we're all in this together.
So come on, let's pull together, let's come together, let's work together in the national interest.
On the one hand, people are sort of feeling guilty for what they've done during the boom, but at the same time, this allows them to continue to spend, but in a way in which they can feel better about themselves. You're kind of performing your own rectitude in a way.
You refer in your book to a line from Douglas Copeland, legislated nostalgia. What was he getting at, and why is that relevant to Keep Calm and Carry On?
This is a kind of nostalgia that's politically useful in a way that's actually quite unusual. It's quite rare to find that something that seems to be that much connected with the interests of the state and government as to Keep Calm and Carry On phenomena. This may be slightly paranoid of me, but I feel that it's actively encouraged by the state. But also at the same time, it's a body of memories people don't possess, not only because most of the people, you know, buying this or seeing this will not have lived through the Second World War. Probably more crucially, even those who did live through the Second World War cannot have seen it.
Now, there's a punchline to this story, Owen, and that is that this poster, which we remember as so symbolic and so ubiquitous during Britain's darkest hour, which was to become Britain's finest hour, wasn't ubiquitous at all. In fact, it barely existed.
This is the dark secret at the heart of Keep Calm and Carry On, I think. I couldn't believe it when I first found this out. The poster was one of three produced in 1940 by the Ministry of Information to put up when the bomb started dropping. One said, "Freedom is in peril, defend it with all your might." And the other said, "Your courage, your fortitude, your something, something will bring us victory." And then there was the third call, which was going to say, "Keep calm and carry on." It was thought that as soon as the bomb started to drop, people would panic. And that this would work as a way of sort of saying to people, don't be so bloody silly, you know, pipe down. And wasn't produced, I think, partly because of the fact that people didn't panic. So the poster, which I think was already considered by researchers to be quite patronizing, was stopped. So it was never, ever on the city streets in London or anywhere else.
And yet when me and evidently about 10 million other people see a poster in a bookstore, we immediately go, oh, yes, of course. Wasn't that a remarkable time and a remarkable bit of courage from these resilient British people in brown tweed?
Exactly. The very fact that it wasn't produced is partly because the people of 1940 wouldn't have, so the assumption went, have welcomed it. And I think that now, of course, the layer of irony goes over that, so people don't feel patronized by it. Because we know, of course, we're not really being bombed by Hitler. But at the same time, that irony is a little bit disavowed and that it is also a response to a crisis. One of the big problems with the poster is that it suggests that austerity is necessary in the way that the war was necessary. Austerity, as currently practiced, is not necessary. It's a political and economic choice. It's not something which is some sort of force of nature we can't control. And I think the poster, as it's currently used, has a certain amount of suggesting a resignation and acceptance of something that there's no reason whatsoever that people ought to be accepting.
Owen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Owen Hatherley is the author of The Ministry of Nostalgia, Consuming Austerity.
Now, don't forget, there's practically nothing you can't use for turning into something useful these days. These are old tablecloths, underwears, ties, collars, socks. Everything's useful. So remember, be patriotic, like me.
We all know about the murder of Kitty Genovese on a New York street in 1964. It dishonored the city, all cities, as the emblem of urban dehumanization. The lead in the New York Times read, "For more than half an hour, 38 respectable, law-abiding citizens in Queens watched a killer stalk and stab a woman in three separate attacks in Kew Gardens." Kitty's teenage brother Bill read the story and believes it made him the man he became. But is the story true? The new documentary, The Witness, follows Bill's long and arduous pursuit of the witnesses to Kitty's death and her life, the so-called witnesses who shamed us all.
Tomorrow marks what many people regard as one of the most shameful anniversaries in New York City history.
50 years ago, her murder led to the adoption of the 911 system.
Police discovered that more than 30 people had witnessed her attack, and no one had picked up the phone to call the police.
James Solomon directed and produced The Witness. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Brooke.
So, the film's narrator, Kitty Genovese's brother, Bill Genovese, was 16 when she was murdered. The film is really about him, isn't it? You've called it a love story.
It is a love story. Bill was determined to reclaim his sister's life from her death. Kitty was, as he describes in the film, his mother and father combined. She heard him, listened to him, affirmed him, validated him. But it wasn't just the fact that he lost this sister who he adored so much, but the way she reportedly died. That story shaped the rest of his life.
You met him in the course of researching a feature film about Kitty Genovese. You are a script writer. Then you decided to make your own directorial debut by creating this documentary with Bill at the heart of it.
What I discovered was that I could not possibly do justice to the story of Kitty Genovese by writing it, that the people who could best tell the story of who she was and what happened that night were the people who actually lived it. Bill was determined to find out for himself what actually happened that night. And so for the past decade, Bill has been on this quest.
Martin Gansberg, who broke the story in the Times in 64, was working under the supervision, essentially, of New York Times editor Abe Rosenthal, who'd spoken to a police chief and later wrote 38 witnesses about the case and about the bystander syndrome, also known as the Genovese syndrome. The New York Times has since written stories revising that original account. What he seems to say is that the story may or may not be entirely true, but the syndrome that I identified that is now being taught in sociology classes is too important to mess with.
I can't swear to God that there were 38 people. Some people say there were more, some people say there were less. But what was true, people all over the world were affected by it. Did it do anything? You bet your eye it did something, and I'm glad it did.
Journalists, as you know, have this saying, some stories are too good to check. And the story of 38 having watched for more than a half hour simply just wasn't true. How did that story come to be? Bill would have to jump back 52 years to get the answer to that by tracking down the journalists who covered it.
One of whom is Mike Wallace.
No one investigated the 38. No one followed up on it or anything of that nature.
Do you have any feel for why that would have been with this case versus any other case?
Because it was taken seriously by the New York Times.
Probably the most important witness he finds is a neighbor of Kitty's and a friend named Sophie Farrar.
Well, think about it. For a half century, your entire family lives off the understanding that your daughter, your sister, died alone. And then you find out, well, actually, she died in the arms of a friend.
It kills me when I think about it. Black leather gloves and all cuts all through the gloves on her both hands. I only hope that she knew it was me, that she wasn't alone.
It makes you question the narratives that shape your life and the way false narratives change the course of your life. Bill's life propelled by a false narrative.
In the film, there's a suggestion that Bill Genovese enlisted in the Marines and went to Vietnam in part as a response to Kitty's murder because he didn't want to be an apathetic bystander to the war in the same way that those witnesses supposedly were to her death. But do you think he really would have acted differently had he known the real story?
Well, Bill answers that question in a variety of ways. He definitely felt that he needed to prove that he was not like those people that night. Even when he was in Vietnam, he was the one who'd raise his hand for every dangerous mission. He's also told me that had Kitty lived, she would have talked him out of going to Vietnam.
One thing that we see is that he is striving against many odds to get to the truth of this story, and he does it without his legs. He travels either in a wheelchair or he just basically slides across the room. He is unselfconscious about that. And yet it seems almost like a visual metaphor in a way for the damage he sustained.
The people who appear in the film, the witnesses who were there that night in particular, it is only because of Bill's understanding, in a sense, of trauma that I think a lot of the people were willing to open up. This is not the selfie generation that are talking, because Bill is extraordinarily empathic as a person, and also because he's walked the walk, people were willing to open up to him. And so what unravels over the course of the film is a level of insight into what happened that night, the effect of it, that I don't think anyone else could have possibly brought out.
Among the people Bill spoke to was the murderer's son, a man named Stephen Mosley, a former prison guard who later became a preacher. You draw an interesting parallel between the two.
They're two men who are stepping outside the comfort zone of their family. They are determined to meet each other for different reasons, but against the desires of their family. And they both are holding on to narratives that in the course of their conversation, are challenged.
Let me just say this here. I was kind of apprehensive about talking to you. From what I've understood, there was a Genovese crime family. Are you related to the crime family of the Genovese?
No, not at all.
I've always been told that it had been the crime family that Kitty was from.
Stephen, between you and me, it's not true.
Everybody in my family says to me, you know, you're crazy. You shouldn't go there. You may not come back.
So you're not only cordial for coming here, but you're courageous for coming here.
Winston Mosley's family and Kitty Genovese's family has been holding to these stories that on closer examination may not be true.
Bill talks about the moment in Vietnam when his legs were off and he thought he would bleed out. And he projected himself back to what he imagined his sister had gone through.
The closest Bill ever got to experiencing what it was like for his sister that night occurred in July of 1967 when Bill was on patrol and a remote-controlled detonated landmine blew up and he was thrown into the rice paddy, waiting and hoping for someone to come to his aid. And finding himself all alone. And he has said that that was the first time in Vietnam he thought of his sister.
Kitty's nieces and nephews, who she'd never met, didn't know who she was. For one of them, her name came up in class in high school. She didn't even realize it was her own aunt.
That is one of the great tragedies. The account of her death was so public and so horrific that it erased her life within her own family. Bill's brother, Vin, in the film, refers to the only way we could deal with her death was to not talk about her life. Kitty was a remarkably fascinating and compelling figure, 28-year-old woman working in a bar, managing the bar.
A live wire in high school who never had any grand intellectual ambitions. She just seemed to want to be free.
We played hooky. We went to the beach or here in the park or smoking on the roof. And she was the head of the pack.
Yeah, she's driving a red Fiat, living with a woman, Marianne. And what Bill does in the film is reveal a person that we all would feel, gosh, I really wish I knew her.
Bill didn't even know she was gay.
He did not. Really, the greatest sadness is for Marianne, who was Kitty's lover. They were living in Kew Gardens. And after she died, the family didn't know, and there was no connection between the family and Marianne until this film. There's a very poignant moment. Bill and Marianne are speaking for the first time in virtually a half century. And Marianne says to Bill, I just wish I could have done something. And Bill says, yeah, I know. Me too, essentially.
Now for the controversial last scene. You hire an actress simply to scream. We meet the actress. There's no effort to make this be a recreation in a History Channel or Discovery Channel sense of the word at all. We see him putting up signs to the neighbors to be aware and not to worry. It is nevertheless horrifying. I wonder if you aren't going to come in for some criticism for how horrifying it is.
The film documents Bill's 11-year journey. And at the end of that journey, Bill had this desire and this need to immerse himself in what took place that night. He had been talking and thinking about what it was like. And with the limitations of a half century, you can't recreate exactly what it was like. But the street stands like a movie set. Austin Street is just the way it was, virtually, as it was 1964. And so on a night on April 1st, 2014, on a night not so dissimilar to the night that his sister was murdered.
No! No! No!
he was able to feel what it was like.
Did you know how this story would end when you began?
Brooke, you know, you knew my brother very well. My brother John was a contributor to this show and became a good friend of this show. And you and this show is a huge place in my heart. In 2004, I was making a film about a brother who lost a sister. I had no personal understanding of that kind of loss. Along the way in making this film, my own brother, John, the person who I looked up to more than anyone in the world, got sick with leukemia and died a couple years later. So what was once an abstract understanding of sibling loss ceased to be. And so, no, I had no idea what the feeling or experience or importance of this film would be like for me. We followed Bill, and I had no idea as to where it would take us. I think Bill and I thought it would take 6 months, a year, never thought it would take 11 years. And his family now knows who Kitty the person was, not just Kitty the victim. Over a half century, this man is determined to reclaim his sister, her life, from her death. It's, in my estimation, the ultimate love story.
James, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke, so much for having me on the media.
James Solomon is the director of The Witness, which is now available on Netflix, iTunes, and Amazon.
Coming up, in Ukraine, a state-appointed archivist is single-handedly cleansing his country's murky past.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. History, for the propagandist, is a powerful resource full of glorious deeds and national tradition. But it's also littered with shameful episodes and inconvenient truths. These, the propagandist is obliged to spin or erase. The Soviet Union excelled at such revisionism. And the legacy continues. Consider the former Soviet Republic, Ukraine, where some of its ugliest chapters are being redacted by an archivist named Vladimir Vyatrovich. And he's doing it, in an ironic turn, to advance Ukraine's narrative as a righteous foe of post-Soviet Russia. Tariq Surreal Amar teaches Soviet, Russian, and Ukrainian history at Columbia University. He was one of 70 scholars who signed an open letter in May protesting attempts by Vyatrovich, head of Ukraine's Institute of National Memory, to whitewash the history of certain nationalist groups during and after World War II.
These nationalists were ethnic cleansers. They also committed mass murder, and to a certain extent, they continued participating in killing Jews, that is, in the Holocaust, even beyond the pogroms of 41. And this is not a question of he said, she said opinion, as Vyatrovich likes to depict it. It's a question of historical fact, as in so many other European societies at that point.
Unlike Germany, there has been no process of truth and reconciliation in Ukraine to deal with its fraught history, but now it is erasing history. Tell me, please, about Vyatrovich and his Institute of National Memory.
Vyatrovich has created the legal basis for transferring control over the most politically sensitive archives, the archives of the former KGB, from this security service to his Institute of National Memory. To have the archives under the control of this particular person is worrying. Vyatrovich uses uncritically document collections that have clearly been manipulated, submitted to retyping, editing of various sorts. If it's good for nationalism, he's all right with it. If it's bad for nationalism, he seeks really any means he can find, including very dubious ones, to dismiss it. He dismisses essentially any testimony by survivors. We must take survivor testimony extremely seriously because, for very simple reasons, perpetrators don't have much incentive to tell us the truth, right? And survivors in large genocides are a small minority. They basically show us the tip of an iceberg.
Vyatrovich, when confronted with the ugliest part of Ukrainian history, likes to say it was complicated.
Yes.
But you find irony in that explanation.
Yeah, bitter irony, to be honest. Vyatrovich actually is not ready to face the complexity. There's a bit of a switcheroo, really, in this discourse. It's always very complex when it comes to the hard issues, but when it comes to public policy, which he shapes, then we are in a position where we can clearly say who should be a hero, and at that, a very pure type of hero, and who should not be.
So it's not just revisionism and denialism. He has now managed to criminalize historical publications or even inquiries that would cast Ukraine in a bad light.
It's usually described as the decommunization laws. That is a bit of a euphemism. Yes, there are laws in there that see to it that, for instance, place names, street names that still are Soviet are replaced, that Soviet monuments, at least many of them, are removed, and so on and so on. But the much more problematic part of these laws is actually not about decommunization, namely making it a criminal offense to show disrespect for what the law calls the fighters for Ukrainian statehood and independence, and those include the World War II nationalists. Now, when the laws were passed by the parliament, there were protests, repeated protests, appealing to the president, Poroshenko, please not to sign them into law. And very unfortunately, he has signed them into law.
Vyatrovich and his institute have put the West in a kind of funny position because it's in the interest of the West, who wish to see Ukraine turn continually West, to impeach Putin's narrative of lingering fascism.
Mm.
There have been some profiles of Vyatrovich in the American press which have been sympathetic, even fawning. What do you make of that?
Well, I really do not like to use a relatively strong term, but I think they are, technically speaking, naive, because he does have the media savvy to present himself in the language Western interlocutors like to hear. And that, of course, is a language of democracy, national inclusivity, overcoming divisions within Ukrainian society. But unfortunately, his actions, including legislation that he shapes, do not correspond to that at all.
The West seems to be repeating its mistakes of the Cold War and putting up with all sorts of nonsense, including a gathering authoritarianism for the sake of the momentary political struggle. How do you see this playing out?
You know, I really can't tell about gathering authoritarianism. Ukraine is actually too pluralist to, in fact, allow Vyatrovich to be entirely successful. However, it is a bit problematic when Western institutions or media treat him as an ordinary scholar, which he's not, because whenever that happens, it's used to bolster his case and his authority inside the Ukrainian public sphere. Let me be clear about something. I mean, this is my personal opinion. I have the greatest sympathy for Ukrainians who want to turn towards the European Union. But we don't do Ukraine any favor if we allow a Vyatrovich to dominate and monopolize the discussion. There are Ukrainian intellectuals and historians who could give us an alternative to the Putinist brutal propaganda narrative that wouldn't put bias against bias, but that really overcome the problem of propaganda as such in showing that Ukrainian society can actually have a frank public discussion and doesn't need another myth to counter an old myth. These resources, these people, let me repeat, exist in Ukraine. And I would wish that we would support them and that we would not support Vyatrovich and also what he stands for.
Tariq, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Tariq Cyril Amar is an associate professor of Ukrainian history at Columbia University.
The philosopher Tsvetan Todorov wrote that the 21st century is, quote, obsessed by a new cult, that of memory. David Reif, author of In Praise of Forgetting, Historical Memory and Its Ironies, says that, in fact, the memorializing of collective historical memory has become one of humanity's highest moral obligations. And that, he says, is a mistake, because collective historical memory has very little to do with history.
History is about the past, whereas memory is about how we use the past for the purposes of the present.
But you don't really think history itself is independent and autonomous, right?
Is there perfect history? Self-evidently not. But I do think history, when done properly, is critical history. Looking at the past and not really caring whether what one finds out helps the good guys and thwarts the bad guys, et cetera, et cetera. There's a great English novel, The Go-Between, by L.P. Hartley. And the first line is, the past is another country. They do things differently there. Whereas memory always seems to me to be deployed in the service of the present.
And you regard Santayana's truism, those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it, as fundamentally false or at least hazardous.
I mean, I don't see how we learn anything from the past. I mean, if you look at the worst things, say the Holocaust, did that stop the genocide in East Pakistan in what became Bangladesh in 1971? Or the mass slaughter in Cambodia when the Khmer Rouge ruled, or the Rwandan genocide? I mean, it doesn't seem to me that knowing about the past has saved anybody. Now, if you're saying, is there a moral obligation to remember, we need to talk about whether or not that moral obligation serves peace, truth, justice. I think there are times when remembrance is a very useful thing, particularly in the immediate aftermath of a terrible event.
Yeah, but if you're talking about in the immediate aftermath, a commemoration and a memory here are two different things. I mean, if the country pulls together after a natural disaster, or say after 9/11 or something like that, that isn't the sort of formation of memory that you're really suspicious of.
In the immediate aftermath of conflicts, a lot of people believe that what you need to do is establish the truth, both for the sake of the victims, so that they have their stories told, and if you're a relative, you know what happened to somebody who was, say, disappeared by the Argentine junta. That seems to me a use of memory that can be very helpful. But again, even then, I don't think it's always helpful. I mean, what do you do, for example, in a divided society which, after a war, still disagrees about pretty much everything? Often, these memories, far from leading to more consensus, more justice, more truth, are just a goad to war.
You reported from Bosnia during the Balkan conflict of the 90s, and you write in the book about having a piece of paper pressed into your hand with a date.
In 1993, I was in Belgrade, and I went to interview a very extreme Serb nationalist politician. And as I was leaving the interview, one of his aides gave me a folded up piece of paper. When I opened the paper, it just had a date written on it, 1453, the date that Christian Constantinople fell to the Turks. I mean, the message was perfectly clear. We're defending the West as the Byzantines defended Christian civilization from the Turks, and that's what we Serbs are doing in Bosnia. That's a goad to massacre.
Do you think that collective historical memory helps ensure that wars never end? You believe that, for instance, the battle over the Confederate flag that's going on now is partly a battle over the memory of the American Civil War, the war that was won by the North, but you suggest the memory was won by the South.
Well, I think it was. You know, the Southern interpretation, the war, brother against brother, nobility on both sides, that was the tenor in the official celebrations of the centennial of the American Civil War. There's a debate about what the war was. And on the northern side, people want to say, well, this was a war to extirpate slavery. There was nothing noble about the southern cause. In the south, it was a commonplace in schools for teachers to literally, with a straight face, talk about the war of northern aggression. The fact that a southern battle flag could fly over various state houses shows you indeed the victory of the southern narrative.
In the aftermath of the Dylann Roof massacre in June last year at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, where 9 people were killed, you said the question of why the Civil War had been fought became, for the first time in decades, part of the mainstream debate. You really think that?
Well, African-American legislators have been trying to get these damned flags taken down, with no success whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened after the massacre in Charleston was that suddenly a lot of white Americans in the South thought, wait a minute, maybe these flags really are an offense.
You note that in resolving the Irish Wars, people essentially agreed to disagree about the past.
Yeah, well, they did, because nobody won. So you have communities that are still convinced of the rightness of their cause, but still also have to live together. And today in Belfast, you'll go from one neighborhood where the Union Jack is flying proudly to another neighborhood where the Irish tricolor is flying proudly. They're coexisting. But that seems to require them to have, in effect, said, in the public discourse, we're going to largely forget about the past and think about the present and the future.
So far, so good, but also so recent. Agreeing to disagree, I don't know what the alternative is, but it isn't a sustainable way of coping with these warring narratives. It seems to simply put off a later conflagration rather than to extinguish it.
And in those cases, my answer would be then those are narratives that should be remembered. You have to judge these things on a case-by-case basis. You can't make memory a sacred task.
In a recent article in The Guardian, you referred to the Edict of Nantes, issued by Henry IV in 1598 to bring an end to the wars of religion in France. Essentially, the edict decreed that in all of the preceding troubles, the memory will remain extinguished and treated as something that did not take place. Rather Soviet, it seems, that formulation. Do you think that could have worked? Can you enforce forgetting, a boundary inside your own head?
Collective memory is not individual memory. There's no such thing in neurological terms as collective memory.
Mm-hmm.
So if collective memory becomes the story we tell ourselves about the past, then of course we can forget. People are engaged in what the philosopher Nietzsche called active forgetting in their private lives a lot. I don't see why there's any reason to say that's impossible in the public life. Whether it's desirable, sometimes it is, and sometimes it is not. Collective memory has been used often as a weapon, and I think, you know, it might be at certain moments better to disarm.
David, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
David Reif is the author of In Praise of Forgetting, Historical Memory and Its Ironies, and we spoke to him in May. Mark Twain once said, "A clear conscience is the sure sign of a bad memory." But memory always fails, because every time we remember, we forget a little, like an image too often photocopied, and we fill in the blanks with unconscious ink. Some suggest that memory's failure to provide exact replicas of experience may actually be wired in. That, as Brian Boyd wrote, our tendency to extract and recombine and reassemble allows us to simulate or imagine or pre-experience events, better enabling us to cope with the future, which offers a novel take on Santayana's famous phrase, because those who too precisely remember the past may not be condemned to repeat it, but they'll be less prepared for what's coming around the bend. Weird, right?
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Paige Cowett. We had more help from Michael Loewinger, Sara Kari, and Leia Fetter. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter's WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.